First of all, thank you very much for inviting me here. First time in Perimeter, in fact, first time in Canada, and I'm really enjoying myself. So I just want to tell you about some work we did with my collaborators, mostly at UT Austin, except for Pratik, who is in Fermilab. And it's basically going to be about something really simple, which is phase space. And so you probably come into this room thinking you know everything you know there's to know about phase space. That's certainly what I thought. But then I learned something that I didn't know. So I'm going to see whether you are also in the same situation. Maybe you already know it. We know that the 7 and 8 TV runs are done. We haven't seen anything. It's all standard model. And so even if we see signal in run 2, probably it's not going to be a huge amount of signal events. So it's really, really important in these circumstances to just kind of get every drop of information from the limited number of signal events that we can hope to get. Okay? And in this particular talk, I'm going to concentrate on mass measurements. Now, if you happen to live in fairyland, very nice things can happen to you. And you know, you can, for example, get resonances, and then you plot a bright Wigner shape, and you know everything there is to know. But of course, we know that life will probably not treat us as kindly. In things that are closer to our everyday life or things that we work on, like SUSY, we typically have chains of decays when we produce new physics that end with invisible particles, so that you can't reconstruct any resonance anywhere. And then there are other things to make your life complicated. If you want to measure masses, you want to deal with combinatorics. You have to weed out the backgrounds. You have to live with the fact that your detector doesn't work perfectly. And finally, what I just mentioned, which is you're not going to get tons and tons of events. So in this talk, I want to concentrate basically all on this and how to get maximum information out of a small batch of events. So I'm going to do something somewhat distasteful, which is for the next 60, 70% of the talk or so, I'm going to assume that we have perfect control of these things. Because I want to see how do I get things to work better with limited statistic without having to worry about these other things so that I can do an apples-to-apples comparison. And at the end, I'll come back and comment on whether these things are going to screw up the things I'm going to be telling you. So, but for now, basically, I'm going to assume a situation where you have, a cascade decay like this, where you know exactly who particles 1, 2, 3 are, and there's no background, and you can basically measure their energies very well at the parton level, essentially. And you know, you can get some approximations to this in certain situations where these are perhaps leptons, et cetera. Clearly, in other cases where you have jets, this is a very bad approximation. But again, this is kind of a just, first of all, conceptually, can I improve on existing things unfolding from these other complications? And then we'll get back. So, okay, phase space. You know all the trivial things you need to know about phase space. Two-body decays are completely trivial. Three-body decays, we all know, are best expressed in the Dalitz way of parameterizing the phase space. And in fact, the very nice thing that happens in the Dalitz parameterization is that the phase space volume element is just a constant. So that means when you have a bunch of these particles decaying, and you just plot them in the Dalitz parameterization, you can essentially even read off the matrix element because the volume element, the phase space volume element, is flat. So you have a direct handle on the amplitude. That's nice. And the question is, well, do we have something like this if we go beyond three-body? Typically, we stop here in our field theory 1 courses when we learn about phase space. And then we say, okay, for n particles, it's just product d cubed pi over 2 pi cubed 2e, and that's it. But this nice thing that we see, for instance, in the Dalitz parameterization, which relies on an entirely Lorentz invariant way of writing the volume element, that we're not very familiar with typically from our field theory courses, for example. What does a volume element like this, written in terms of dmij squared, look like for four final state particles, five final state particles, et cetera? Is it flat? I didn't know at first. So now, if you want to measure masses, right, that's really all about looking at phase space. And in particular, it's looking at the boundary of phase space. Like we see in the Dawlitz case, what's inside the kinematically accessible region has more to do with the matrix element, you know, where the rate grows or gets smaller. But the masses of all the particles that are involved will determine the boundary. And so if I can determine where the boundary is, I've measured all the masses, essentially. So how do we do this? Again, let's go back to the basics. We know how to do this for three particles. Let's say X, the case to 1, 2, and 3. You have all the Dawlitz space available. Of course, if 3 is invisible, now you cannot read M12 and M23 separately. So you project everything down to the only thing you can measure, which is M12. And so just because you're running out of area as you go towards this, this limiting value, the rate drops. And so you get what we all call the endpoint. And if you have an on-shell stage in the middle, then that the matrix element now gives you, in the narrow width approximation, it just picks a slice. So now you don't just smoothly run out of phase space as you go towards the right. You just immediately run out of phase space as you follow along the constraint. So that's what we call the edge. So we know these things. But let's talk about what happens as we go to higher cascades, the longer cascades. Now you might ask, who cares? I know how to do 2 and 3 body decays. Any cascade can be decomposed into a sequence of 2 and 3 body decays. It's just phase space. So why don't I just divide it up into subsequent decays and I'm done. I just need to plot all the edges and endpoints that I care about and that's it. So I am here to tell you that if you do that, you miss some information. And that information can actually go a long way. So among other things, one thing that I'll mention is that, of course, we know that edges and endpoints are all sensitive to mass differences. So if I take a spectrum and move it up and down kind of entirely, mostly edges and endpoints are pretty insensitive to that. And it would be nice to get a handle on that, among other things. So let's check our intuition that we can just subdivide a long cascade into multiple on-shell stages. So let's say we have some particle with four momentum p decaying into multiple particles with momenta pi. So there is the familiar way to write the n particle phase space. And you probably know what I'm going to tell you, but I'm just going to tell you that it's OK to just decompose this thing. So you just integrate in a new particle, call it x. And so there's a d4px integral, and you just change your delta function to two delta functions, which are automatically satisfied as you integrate over px. It just gives you back the first line. Okay, but now I've written it in a suggestive way so that this part looks like the m particle, or rather n minus m particle phase space here. And I can do the d4px integral, or rather I can change the px0 integral into a mx squared integral by just doing a simple change of variables. And once I've done that, now it looks like m particle phase space volume element, n minus m particle phase space volume element, where the x is the px is the momenta that links these two, and you have to do an integral over mx squared. So if you didn't know, this is, you know, mathematical proof that you can take any complicated phase space, subdivide it into two subsets, and as long as you integrate over the invariant mass squared of one of the subsets, that works. Okay? So what are we missing here? Are we missing anything? So naively, no, we're not missing anything. We just subdivide the phase space and that's it. However, of course, there is still the integral over mx to be done. So if x is an actual on-shell particle, then that's fine. The narrow width takes the mx integral. But if it isn't, then there are some correlations through that. But more importantly, and this is the thing I really care about, is that You can also look at invariant masses, or rather, you know, Lorentz invariant observables from one momentum in one subspace and momentum, another momentum in the other subspace. And those, you know, you don't really get any wiser about those when you do the decomposition. So let me just paint for you just a caricature of what I'm after here. And that really should, I think this plot summarizes pretty much everything I've said so far. So imagine this following decay. Okay, so X is a particle that first undergoes a 2-body decay, and then Y undergoes a 3-body decay, where particle 4 is invisible. So if you are familiar with your edges and endpoints, you could, for example, say, okay, let me forget about X for a second. Y decays to 3 particles. That's an endpoint in M23. So you can plot M23, you expect an endpoint. Great. Or you could say, well, let me group 2 and 3 together, consider them like a composite particle with mass M23. Now it's an edge. X goes to Y, and then this composite particle, and 4, which I don't see. So for any particular mass of M23, for any particular mass of this composite particle, which is for a vertical slice here, you get an edge. That's fine, too, so you know where to find the edge. Okay. Now, if you have different hypotheses for, say, the masses of X and Y and 4, you'll map out different boundaries in this phase space that I've here. I've just projected onto two variables. Now, consider the following. Consider you get a single event, okay? And the single event is represented by this red dot over here. Let's say you're doing edges and endpoints. So you project this thing down into M1, 2, 3. That's the edge I told you about. Or you project it, well, you project to the left, or you project down to M23. In either case, the red dot kind of ends up right in the middle of the histogram. And it doesn't tell you much. But then you look at the correlations, and if you have two separate hypotheses, say, one may give you a boundary over here, another may give you this dashed boundary, and then a single event can make all the difference in the world. Okay, so that's the kind of correlation that I'm after. So let's look at a little bit more detail in what the phase space looks like. So of course, for n final state particles, we have 3n momenta. We subtract 4 for energy momentum conservation and 3 for rotational invariance. Now, if you want to write this the volume element in this phase space in terms of the MIJs, well, there's of order m squared of those. So there's clearly a lot more as n, or, well, sorry, I should have used n. Oh, sorry, I know what I'm doing. M is visible final state particles, n is total number of final state particles. But even if you have less than n visible final state particles, still quickly, the number of Lorentz invariant observables grows pretty large because it goes like m squared. So in general, you don't expect these guys to be independent, and they are not. However, again, various correlations here are going to be important. So at this point, what you should be asking me is, okay, so you've shown me this caricature. You've shown me that if there are events that are close to the boundary, then they can make a big difference in mass measurements. But why should I expect there to be a lot of events close to the boundary? And that really is, that was the one thing that surprised me more than anything else, is that you actually find that events accumulate at the boundary under certain circumstances. So let's, again, move towards a Lorentz invariant description of the boundary of many-body phase space. So imagine that the decay we're talking about has this form, momentum capital P decays into these momenta Pi, and then form this matrix, which I'm going to call Z, which is just all the Pi dot Pj's. Okay? So now, if all the final state momenta span all of 3 plus 1 dimensional space, then you have, in principle, one positive and 3 negative eigenvalues. But if the final state momenta span only a subset of 3 plus 1 dimensional space, of 3 plus 1 dimensional space, then the number of negative eigenvalues goes down to 2, 1, or 0. 0 would be basically a particle just decaying at rest to a bunch of particles who stay at the same point with no momenta at all. That's the extreme case. Okay? So the number of eigenvalues, positive and negative eigenvalues of this matrix basically tells me about where I am in the phase space, and in particular, where is the boundary of phase space? Well, the boundary of phase space is when the final state particles are just beginning to fail to span all three spatial dimensions. Okay, so that's the most general way of saying it. So if I look at the boundary of the kinematically allowed region, that's when the number of eigenvalues is just switching from being 3 negative and 1 positive to 2 negative and 1 positive. And there is a mathematically convenient way to write this. You just write down the characteristic polynomial for z, and you label the coefficients of the, you know, counting from the highest power of lambda down, you label the coefficients of these guys, delta 1, delta 2, delta 3, et cetera. So as you can clearly easily check just by looking at it, just demanding that you have four non-zero eigenvalues tells you that delta 1, 2, 3, 4 should be non-zero. And then everything else should be zero because you can't span more than 3 plus 1 dimensions if you actually live in four-dimensional space. So the boundary is where you're just, where delta 4 is just becoming zero. Okay, so now we have a very general way, a Lorentz invariant way, to say where the boundary of phase space is. So, but what we're really after is the volume element of phase space. And this can get complicated, but I'm just going to tell you the simplest case that you don't already know the answer to, which is for four final state particles. So for four final state particles, remember, Z is a 4x4 matrix, and you can easily see that delta 4 is just the, well, up to a sign, it's the determinant of that matrix. And if you write the volume element for four particle phase space, it looks something like this. You still have an integral over all the MIJ squareds, and then you have a single delta function, not delta 4, a single delta function that ensures basically that PI through P1 through P4 added up and squared gives you the correct mass. But then you have this guy. Okay, so this was the thing that surprised me, which is 1 over square root delta 4. So I've just told you in the previous slide that the boundary of phase space lies at delta 4 equals 0. Here I have 1 over square root delta 4. So this thing is actually enhanced at the boundary as you get towards... Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, that is absolutely a product. That's a typo. Sorry about that. Indeed. And finally, you know, and moreover, you might say, well, that's just an illusion. For example, when I have intermediate particles that go on shell, those are going to give me through narrow width some sort of factors that are just going to cancel this thing out. But that's not the case. As you can tell, first of all, the on-shell mass constraint is linear in the MIJ squareds. Remember, I'm integrating over MIJ squared, so that those are my integration variables. So this is just a linear function of the MIJ squareds. And similarly, any on-shell intermediate particles, what you get from narrow width is also going to be linear in the MIJ squareds. So you don't get from the matrix element anything that cancels this. And you also don't get any Jacobians that cancel this. So it's really there. So let's look at a kind of a class of four final state decay chains and just pick one or two that are interesting to us and actually see if we can take this enhancement and do something with it. Now, the simplest thing you can write down is just a particle decaying to four final state particles, no intermediate resonances whatsoever. That's an interesting case. However, in nature, we have nothing like that. Furthermore, even in our extensions of the standard model, we have nothing like that. So I'm going to skip that just because we don't have any examples of it. You could have what's called the antler topology, which is x goes to y and z, and then y and z decay both to two particles each. Here you have two possibilities. Either you have invisible particles on both the branches of the antler, but that's not the case I want to concentrate on. I want to concentrate on these cases where you have exactly one invisible particle per decay chain. Or you have, you know, you have to assume that the, both particles in one of the antlers is visible, but in that case, it's secretly a 3-bar decay. I should really just not even look at 1, 2. I should consider this as x goes to y plus 3, 4. And then it's not 4 final state particles, and there is not any enhancement. We're just back to Dalits. So the first one that you might find interesting is just this long cascade. Two-body decay after two-body decay until you get visible particles 1, 2, 3, and an invisible particle 4. So we'll look at that. However, keep in mind, this is actually a case where with simpler methods, just by algebraically solving basically for all the masses, you have enough information to reconstruct everything here. So why do I take time to even tell you about this? Because it's going to be a kind of a stepping stone to the next case, which is a little more interesting to me, which is this one. So here we have a two-body decay followed by a three-body decay. And this one you can't do with polynomial methods. Okay? And this is the one where I'm really going to test what I'm doing versus edges and endpoints and see how much of an improvement I get. Okay? So this is the case that I'm really interested in. Of course, you can also do three-body decay followed by a two-body decay, but it's going to be very similar to this, so I'm not going to do that separately. Okay, how am I doing on time? And you might ask, by the way, who cares? Do these things ever show up? Well, maybe they're not your most kind of bread-and-butter type of signals, but in principle, you could get them in motivated extensions of the standard model. For instance, you could, let's say you have SUSY, but the squarks are somewhat heavy. You can't pair-produce them. You can singly produce them, though, and then let's say they decay through some on-shell sleptons. And there are similar other diagrams you can draw with chargino-neutralino production, with on-shell sleptons or off-shell sleptons, for that matter. Or single gluino, again, if you have heavy gluinos, you could have single gluino with an LSP produced. And these are all cases where I'm justified in focusing all my attention on one side of the event and not care too much about the other side of the event. Okay, so what do I want to do? I want to take some scenario like this, where basically the event I care about is all about you produce one heavy particle, it decays through one of these two chains that I showed you. And I want to analyze that chain, get all the masses using edges and endpoints, and I want to do it again, but using now this enhancement and the full correlated phase space. And I want to just compare both the accuracy and the precision of those measurements. Do I get the central value right, and do I get a narrower distribution for that mass? Okay. So we have to set up two analyses, one for edges and endpoints and one for the full phase space. And basically, the idea is going to be I'm going to give you data sets of fixed length, let's say 100 events per universe, where you run your LHC or your experiment. And in both cases, we're going to basically scan over a whole bunch of mass hypotheses for the masses of all unknown particles, and the analysis is going to pick a winner among all the hypotheses. Say this fits the data best. This little sample of 100 events is best fit by this combination of masses. And then we're going to keep track of which mass combination wins in many copies of this experiment. And that's going to give us a distribution for how well we can measure the mass. If that's a very broad distribution, we have then bad precision, even though we may have good accuracy. Okay, so we'll just do many such pseudo experiments and collect the results. This is easy to set up for the edge and endpoint analysis. All I have to do is come up with some sort of quality of fit. So you give me a mass hypothesis. Out of that, I can predict where all the edges and endpoints should lie. And here I'm literally taking every possible combination for these on-shell decay stages, all the edges and endpoints you might care about. And basically, in the data, what I'm going to do is, among the 100 events, I'll pick the one that gives me the maximum value for that variable. So that's the measured position of the endpoint. Here's the predicted position of the endpoint based on my hypothesis for the masses. And I normalize this to the measured ones, and I just square and sum. Okay, so that's a good test. So that's some quality variable that I can use to rank various mass hypotheses. It's a little trickier to do this for the full phase space. So how do I find some sort of quality of fit variable if I have a boundary that is not just labeled by a single position, but it's multidimensional. Now, if you have this situation, let's say you have two possible hypotheses, they give you two separate boundaries, and then you have an event that lies in between, great, that's easy because I can say the dashed line is clearly incompatible with this single event. As I told you, I'm using perfect detector resolution, so I don't have to worry about events leaking out. But it's a little harder if the event lies within both hypothesized boundaries. And here is where the enhancement comes in. So remember that the phase space volume element likes these events to be close to the boundary. So it should prefer the kind of the boundary that fits more snugly than the one that expands out. So I need something that tells me, A, whether I'm including all the events, and B, whether the fit is as snug as possible. But I basically just said the words, so it's going to be easy to write down the formula. It's all about what the volume element wants. So let's just ask the question, what does the volume element want? So I basically want a probability, given a data sample, and given a mass hypothesis, I want to ask the question, you know, what is the likelihood of getting that mass, you know, that this is the right mass hypothesis based on the data. Of course, this is hard to compute, but you use Bayes' theorem and flip things around, and you write it in terms of, instead, given the mass hypothesis, what is the likelihood that I'm going to get the data. There is some prior involved, which I'm going to essentially assume is flat. You can play other games, but I think the result really doesn't change, and you get some normalization factor that you don't care about. Now, this is the thing you can compute. Given a mass hypothesis, I know the volume elements, so I can just plug my events in, tell me, and tells me what the likelihood was. Okay, so basically now I'm just multiplying over all the events. Given a mass hypothesis, what is the chance that I would have gotten the particular data that I got? Now, the probability, of course, depends on both the matrix element and the phase space. So again, to just do the simplest apples-to-apples comparison that is possible, I'm going to also assume everything's a scalar. Let's just concentrate on phase space for now. So the matrix element can almost entirely be ignored, except that I want to keep things that affect the phase space, like, for instance, narrow width propagators. Those are the things I need to keep. Also, things like widths I need to keep, because the widths themselves are mass dependent, so they're going to bias the likelihood a little bit. So anything that can depend on my hypothesis for the unknown masses, I need to keep. Okay, and then I have to ask the question, this thing, the phase space volume, of course, has multiple integrals, so are those all taken, or do I have to take them manually? So here's where the warm-up exercise comes in handy, so this one. This one is easy because once you impose narrow width approximation, so what are the MIJs here? The visible ones are, of course, M12, M13, M23, those I see. The ones I don't see are M14, M24, M34. But this is simple because once you measure the visible ones, the invisible ones are automatically determined. For instance, given the mass hypothesis, you can use MZ, the hypothesized MZ, to get M34. And then you can use the hypothesized MY to get M24, et cetera. Work your way backwards. You get all the MI4s that way. That means once you put in narrow width propagators, in the phase-based volume element, all the integrals are taken, and it looks something like this. Note that I'm keeping the couplings here because they affect also the widths, which I'm also keeping. So I have to be very careful here that I'm not biasing this in any way. These are the narrow width propagators. That's just the normalization of the phase space, and that's the 1 over square root delta 4. That's the guy I really care about. And of course, I have to make sure that all the widths that I write down here have to be computed with respect to the hypothesized masses, not the true masses. And the final thing I have to be careful about is that this likelihood should not have a bias between hypotheses. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is when the hypothesis that I'm talking about is the true hypothesis, the true masses, then I should get, let's say, some constant value, let's say 1, okay? And that should be independent of who's the true mass. So If I take two separate experiments where the true masses are different, I shouldn't get a higher value for the likelihood in one versus the other once I plug in the correct hypothesis. Okay, so I basically ensure that by dividing by 1 over gamma x, because the rest, of course, is just gamma x. Okay, this looks, I mean, this is a seems like a very deep point of detail, but it's important because it really biases. The way you normalize this thing really has to be unbiased to where the mx, my, and mz are. Okay. Okay, so now let's get to the case where I'm the one that I'm more interested in, which is this two-body decay followed by a three-body decay. I'm sorry, I forgot something. So, okay, so you just do your math. The couplings here cancel nicely with the widths in the denominator, and the whole thing simplifies quite a bit. So at the end, basically the likelihood function you want to maximize is just this one. But of course, the part I really care about is this 1 over square root delta 4. Everything else, just make sure that things are unbiased. Okay, so now I get to the case where I'm more interested in, which is the two-body decay followed by a three-body decay. Here, you can't do that trick of reconstructing all the invisible Mij squareds. So there is no way for you to fix M34, and therefore the M34 integral remains undone. But of course, for every value of M34 in this integral, now you can fix the other guys, so that's fine. So you're only left with one undone integral. And as it turns out, even though this looks formidable, just mainly because delta 4 is a very complicated function, it turns out you can do this analytically. I'm not going to show you the answer. It doesn't look particularly illuminating, but you can do it analytically. So we're not just numerically fumbling around here. Okay, so now it's time to just compare what I get with edges and endpoints alone, and then with the fully correlated phase space. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take some representative mass spectrum. So this is the true mass of x, y, z, and 4 that goes into the experiment. I'm going to get a bunch of data samples with 100 events each, many such data samples. And then I'm going to scan in my hypothesized masses. I'm going to scan around the true value, and then I'll parameterize I'll set up my coordinates in mx, my, mz, m4 space such that one direction that I want to keep track of is the flat direction, where I raise or lower all the unknown masses by the same amount. Because I expect, especially in the edge and endpoint analysis, I expect a flat direction in the direction of that. And so without further ado, here's what it looks like. So light blue is what you get from edges and endpoints. Dark blue is what you get from the fully correlated phase space. Now, you know already that I'm cheating here. I'm assuming perfect resolution, et cetera. But this is still pretty impressive, is that this is exactly the flat direction that I'm talking about here. So the alpha direction, where all the masses are raised and lowered by the same amount. But even in the other directions, it really gets narrower. I could have made narrower histograms for the light blue too, but there was no point. I just want you to see that where the central value is and where the spread is. So the correlated phase space really nails this down. And the edges and endpoints don't do so well. Here it is in terms of the actual masses rather than these alpha beta directions. But of course, here everything is dominated by the spread in alpha. So these are not, I think these are a more interesting set of plots to look at just because alpha has some physical significance, but the actual masses are then all dominated by the thing that's measured worst.
Sorry, can you go back to the definition of the.
Sorry, definition of what?
Okay, so the V sigma 1 is that.
So, right, so. So alpha, when alpha, beta, gamma, and delta, so alpha, beta, gamma, and delta are my coordinates in hypothesized mass space. And alpha, beta, gamma, delta all equal to 0, so the origin corresponds to the true hypothesis. So I expect, you know, the best fit to be, you know, where alpha, beta, gamma, delta are all 0. And then the way I've normalized this is that a unit excursion in any one of these coordinates corresponds to 100 GeV So let's say if I said alpha equals 1, that means...
What are the other...
Good. They are just directions that are orthogonal to this, and I can show them to you. They're in the backup slides, but they're not particularly interesting. There are things like, you know, you raise two of the masses and, you know, load
okay,
two of the others.
I'm wondering, it's like if you took something that was that had one flat direction, and then three really good directions.
Right.
And you projected a little bit off of the flat direction,
well,
you would get something like this, which I don't believe it's actually the case here.
Well, you can, so here, let me see if the following answer makes you a little happier. So if you look at the beta, gamma, delta here, they are really not all that different from each other. They all have, you know, percentage sensitivity. But as far as I know, and if this is your question, there is no, so once I picked out alpha, there is no specific direction in the beta, gamma, delta subspace that is particularly good or particularly bad. As far as I can tell, this is entirely democratic. Okay. And here are the numerical values, if you happen to care. So the individual masses, or let me start with alpha. With the phase space analysis, you can measure alpha to order 10 to the minus 3, whereas, of course, the edge and endpoint methods completely crap out here. But even in the other, the better directions, so the things that you think you get well with the edge and endpoints, you get, again, kind of, well, I mean, you really get ridiculous sensitivity. And that's partly because I've assumed, well, that's mostly because I've assumed perfect detector. But even so, you can tell you have basically kind of an order of magnitude-ish improvement on top of the edges and endpoints. So, but of course, what I really care about is this guy. And so let's do the exact same thing. Let's take a benchmark spectrum, so some true mass for X and Y and the invisible guy. And I scan in the exact same way. Now there's one less direction because there's one less unknown mass. But alpha, again, corresponds to the flat direction. And once again, a unit excursion in any variable corresponds to 100 GV, adding 100 GV to all the various masses. Here, I also want to keep track of how does this change as I change the number of signal events. So remember, part of my motivation here is that I should be able to do well with small signal samples. So let me just compare event samples with 100 events and 1,000 events just to see what the behavior looks like. Now here's something slightly interesting, which is in alpha. So first of all, the one thing you'll notice is that the blue now doesn't nail it exactly. There's some width that we can resolve. But the edges and endpoints, in this case, not only are less precise, but they're also less accurate. The central value for alpha actually shifts to lower values. So in this particular cascade decay, the masses are all measured at low statistics, are all measured to be somewhat lower than they really are. And I'll show you a plot in a few slides why that is. Beta and gamma, you can tell the improvement is not as drastic as we've shown in the simple case of the many two-body decays, but still the dark blue histogram is narrower than the light blue, although in this case at least edges and endpoints do get the central value right, so they're accurate but not all that precise for beta and gamma. Here it is in terms of the actual masses, and once again this is entirely dominated by alpha, so the fact that alpha is low shifts everything to low values, and the spread also is dominated by alpha. Sorry, that was n equals 1,000. Here's n equals 100. So of course, as you go to low statistics, even the correlated phase space measurement broadens out. But the conclusion persists that the edges and endpoints are biased towards low values. And they are or maybe factor of two or so more spread than the correlated phase space. And here it is again in terms of the actual masses. So, and then these are the numerical values. Again, if you care, let's see. I don't know if it's worth going through this really, but there is typically in alpha especially there's a big difference. I'm sorry, should be comparing this to this and this to this. So this is with 100 events, 1,000 events. I can keep this up if you want to stare at it, but I doubt it. So So what's driving this thing? What's driving alpha to lower values? That's not too hard to see. So here what I'm showing you is if I take the entire spectrum, so this is the alpha direction, and I raise everything up or down, so that M4, the mass of the invisible particle, of which the true value is 100, so this is the true value, if I take that and move it up and down, this is where is the predicted position of various edges and endpoints. So you can look at the end of the histogram for M12, M23, and as you can tell, those are pretty flat. So what ends up dominating the quality of fit for the edges and endpoint analysis is where the value of the M13 histogram is, and it's downward sloping. So for a spectrum that is raised, you actually get an endpoint that occurs at lower values. Well, of course, when you have limited statistics and you are measuring the position of the endpoint just by the highest event that you've got, that means whether you want to or not, you know, you never end up quite at the true value. You always end up a little bit lower. And that's why, this is still the three-stage cascade. So the following 2 plus 2 by the 2 by the 2 by the. So if you have limited statistic, you're going to invariably end up somewhere below the actual position, the true position of the endpoint, which will bias you towards higher values. Okay, so this is also a show of the quality of fit. So the quality of fit for the 1-3 histogram just biases you to higher values of the entire spectrum. In the two-stage cascade, this is reversed. So there are a couple of endpoints, 2-3, 1-2-3, that are exactly flat, and there are a couple that depend somewhat on alpha, if you want to call it that, so 1-2 and 1-3. But in this case, you see they're upward sloping. So that means at low statistic, again, you invariably end up at low values for the position of the endpoint, which in this case drives you towards low values for the masses. So that's what's driving alpha in each case. Okay, so now let me try and convince you that I'm not being completely naive, that you know all the assumptions and the simplifications I did are not insane. First of all, I looked at events that had only one side and not the other side. So how is this going to change if I move to events where I have symmetric decays on both sides? Well, if you just want to do likelihoods, you can just, anybody can do likelihoods. So you can always set up a likelihood no matter how complicated the event is. What I would really like to do, the thing I like about it, about the way we set things up before, is that I could write everything down in terms of Lorentz invariant observables. Now, for symmetric events, that's a little tricky because you have to write down the missing energy constraint, and that's really you know, not easy to write down in a Lorentz invariant way, although you can kind of fake it. You can take reference four momenta for the frame of the experiment, for instance, or rather reference momenta for the beam, and then you can write it in terms of four products involving those guys. But the more interesting question to me is whether you have one side or two sides, as you consider longer cascades, we know that for very long cascades, the polynomial methods can just solve everything. So what are the subset of topologies where these kind of methods can do better than just solving everything, just doing polynomial methods? And there's a finite number of them, but I think they are non-negligible. And they include the cascade we looked at. What about the matrix element? I ignored the matrix element. I took everything to be scalars. Well, like we discussed in the Dalitz case, mostly the matrix element is important in the interior. So, you know, it changes the distribution of events, but it won't change where the boundary is. And in fact, you can turn this around and say, well, you know what? I mean, you can actually use this to, of course, try and see what the spins are that occur, that show up in your cascade decay. That's not a new idea. Of course, the matrix element methods do this all the time. And they, you know, for example, for the top quark, et cetera, this has been used extensively. But my point is a little more general than this. So first of all, what I'm talking about is all about the boundary. And I want to, in particular, take advantage of this enhancement at the boundary of multi-body phase space, which for the top, actually, you don't see. The top decay is too short for that. Detector resolution. I mean, that should really be on your mind. It's again, if you all you want to do is set up a likelihood, that's not hard. You just convolute everything you have with some sort of detector response function, some spread, Gaussian perhaps. Can you do it in a Lorentz invariant way? Well, that's going to be tough. Maybe you can kind of model it as just taking a forward momentum and spreading the magnitude of the forward vector in some way. But at the end, it's not too crucial. Combinatorics, you know, again, likelihood actually makes it easier to sum over permutations, and those that give you a good fit will win. So I'm actually thinking that combinatorics are not going to be a major problem. In fact, combinatorics, including combinatorics, may increase the gain that the correlated phase space measurement gives you. Background. So you can do, again, you know, if all you want to do is likelihoods, you can do a joint likelihood. For each event, you just have to include a probability of whether it came from signal or whether it came from background. And that may require some modeling of the background. But I think, and this is, you know, in the works, but if you just even assume some flat distribution for the background, or even do something more general, like try to come up with some way that is insensitive to what the shape of the background is, I think you're going to get a good result. There's just a visual way of thinking about this. And in fact, this also has to do with, well, what do analysis cuts do to mass measurement analyses? And in particular, when you're relying on one-dimensional distributions like edges and endpoints, analysis cuts can actually really bias you. You know, if you're cutting very harshly on momenta, et cetera, they can move things around, they can move shapes around. Whereas if you have some, let's say you're looking at some potato in, you know, in three dimensions, and somebody slices off half the potato, you can still see that it's a potato. And, you know, you can still fit it pretty well. By the time you fit half the potato, you probably got the other half not too badly. But if you just look at a bunch of 1D variables, your fit is not going to be too well. Your fit is not necessarily going to be very well if you cut this thing in half. The thing I really want to spend a few minutes talking about is what happens when you go to longer cascades. So I've told you about n=4. You might be wondering, well, does it get better as you go to 5 final state particles, 6 final state particles, et cetera? Now, as I told you, you can actually just use polynomial methods in very long cascades. But, I mean, there's just this question of, well, there was this enhancement that I never heard about before. So what happens to that as you go to longer cascades? And naively, you might think, well, Dalitz was flat, 4 final state particles was enhanced. So maybe as I go to 5 or 6, it's going to get even more and more and more enhanced. Surprisingly, that happens to not be the case, at least naively. So I didn't write down for you the volume, the phase space element for 5 or more final state particles because it gets complicated. But it looks something like this. Okay, so you have the square root delta 4 factor, and its power is n-5. And then you have a bunch of weird delta functions. So let's look at what these delta functions are. So remember that the deltas were telling us that the momenta that we have, the final state momenta, were spanning 3 or 2 or 1 or 0 space dimensions, but not more. So if you had 5 momenta, in principle, this formula is very general. This formula actually doesn't know yet what the dimensionality of space-time is. Okay, so therefore, it must include a factor that tells you, by the way, you know, you momenta, you better not span more than 3 space dimensions. That's why you have to include this delta of delta 5. This just tells you that, okay, you know, span 3+1 dimensions, but no more. If you have 6 momenta, you have to also ask that you don't span 6, you know, et cetera. So you don't want to span now the full, more than 3+1. Dimensions in space and time. So these are what they do. But you might notice something weird here, right? So we know that the dimension of phase space grows linearly in n. Every new particle you add gives you 3 new momenta, right? So asymptotic limit, the dimension of this is like 3n plus constant. But look at this. So I have, you know, n squared integration variables here, and only of order n delta functions. So how does that even make sense? The dimensionality doesn't seem to work. And as it turns out, these delta functions are really weird. So for instance, imagine an integral like this, where you have a two-dimensional integral, and then you hit it with a delta function of, say, x squared plus y squared minus r squared. That fixes you to lie on some circle. So you know the usual rule of thumb, every delta function kills one integration variable. But if you have now happen to take this r parameter to zero, there's some critical point where the delta function actually pins you down to the exact origin. So it kills not one integral, but two integrals. So and these delta functions are of that kind. They are highly singular. The things that are inside are highly singular. So they actually, this kills one integral. The next one kills two integrals, three integrals, et cetera. And then the numbers work out. But what is even weirder is, well, I shouldn't say weirder, but what I'm trying to do right now is, so let's look actually, well, what am I after? So if you just look at this formula, it looks like, you know, you get your enhancement for n equals 4, at n equals 5 it disappears, and in fact at n equals 6 or higher, you get not only not enhanced, but you get a dilution at the boundary. That looks weird, right? Because I told you that you can take six-dimensional phase space and break it down into two subspaces. One is, say, four final states, and the other one is two final states. So what's going on? I should get the enhancement from the four subspace even when I do the full thing. That turns out to be a little naive because the convolution between the two subspaces actually smears out the enhancement. But you might still wonder, well, there's a lot of weird Jacobians here in living in these guys. And what if they, you know, change the naive behavior of how you scale with delta 4? So that's my worry. And I've been trying to calculate this a little bit. And I'm coming more and more to the conclusion that the naive expectation may actually be true. That as you go from 4 to 5 to 6, for example, you really do lose the enhancement. So there is something special about 4. And really, even though I don't really have, I don't want to inundate you with equations, but it has something to do that with the fact that we live in four dimensions. But if that's the case, well, I should have shown you this earlier. But if that's the case, that suggests to me the following conclusion, which has yet to be tested, so this is speculative, but that if you have a long cascade, and if you want to get those masses, measure those masses as accurately as possible, you don't want to break it down into the smallest possible bits, which are individual edges and endpoints, but you also don't want to do it all at once. It seems to me that you kind of want to break it down into blocks or four and just see what comes out of that. Now, I have to actually do that and look at the results, so I don't want to promise you that that is the best way to do it, but if you put a gun to my head right now and ask me, you know, what do you think, that's what I think, is that there's something special about four. All right, so let me conclude. LHC run 2 is coming. If we get signal, probably there's not going to be a lot of events in there. And so if we look at this correlated phase space analysis, we get this enhancement the boundary that allows us to measure masses more accurately. To do this, I had to set up a likelihood method, which many people find distasteful, saying anybody can do likelihood. What's so special about that? Well, I want to basically counter by saying I don't want to live and die by the likelihood. If you find any other way to kind of a more elegant way to take advantage of this enhancement, please tell me. I'd love to hear it. At this point, the best way I've found is by the likelihood, but I'm not, as I said, I don't want to live and die by it. But at least in that case, for that simple analysis, comparing to, you know, doing an apples-to-apples comparison to edge and endpoint analysis, it looks like you really get an improvement both in the central value of the mass measurement and in the spread, and especially in this flat direction where all the masses are raised and lowered. Now, if you want to put all the other things in that are required for a realistic analysis, such as detector resolution, combinatorics, all that good stuff, I know pretty much how to do it with a likelihood. There may be a better way to do it, or at least there may be a more elegant way to do it with the likelihood, but that's work in progress. So I'll stop here, and thank you for the opportunity. Okay. Thank you.